Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Peter Dale Scott. Peter Dale Scott is a professor emeritus of English at the University of California at Berkeley, and his new book, just published by UC Press, is The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Power, and the Future of America. Peter, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Harry. Glad to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I'm a Canadian. I was born in Montreal, and my first job was teaching at McGill University, where I got my PhD.
And what was your degree in from McGill, your PhD?
I got a PhD in political science.
And what in political science interested you?
It was a political theory thesis. I wanted to write about Hegel. And they assured me I would never get a job if I studied. I was ahead of the wave by about 2 years. And so they said, write about anything. And I said, anything? They said, yes. And I said, how about the political ideas of T.S. Eliot? And they said, great. So I managed to marry the two parts of my schizophrenic self by writing about a poet in a political science dissertation.
So you actually have brought both of these genes to the table as you've developed your career, because you're in the English department here at Berkeley, but you do a lot of writing on issues of international politics.
Most of my publication has been in politics, and all of my teaching for 35 years was English, yes.
And what did you do after you left the university with a PhD?
Well, I taught 1 year, but partly for family reasons, my father was a professor. I wanted very much to get out of the university business. My feeling was I'd do anything with my life except be a professor. And there was a chance to take the foreign service exams in Canada, and I took them and passed. So I was a diplomat for 4 years and enjoyed it very much. And it was in some nice places, the UN, Geneva, Austria, Poland. But then I realized that I'd probably be better off in a university after all. So I came back with my tail between my legs and have been teaching it until I retired.
And what did you take from this experience as a diplomat? Because at one point you were stationed in Poland, I believe you told me, and the experience there and this range of experience sort of informed your perspective in the way you looked at international politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a general way, it was very interesting to live behind the Iron Curtain. And I saw some of the things that are really very bad about life behind the Iron Curtain and other things that weren't so bad. So I had a mixed evaluation of it in Poland. Poland was probably the best place to be if you're going to be behind the Iron Curtain. And then in a much narrower way, it had a huge influence on my later life, because just by coincidence, I was there 59 to 61.
In Warsaw.
I was 4 years in the diplomatic, and the last two were in Warsaw. And as it happened, Canada, India, and Poland had been charged with overseeing the enforcement of the Geneva Accords of 1954 in Indochina. So we used to get by sea huge stacks of cables about Indochina. And because I was the junior member of the embassy, it was my chore to read them. I never thought that we had nothing to do with it in Warsaw. It was just for information in case something came up. Nothing ever did. But it meant that when I left the diplomatic service, came to Berkeley in 1961, I didn't carry any specific memories from the cables except a sense that something was going terribly wrong, and that most of the other countries, Canada, it was one of the rare times that Canada and America really had a different point of view, because Canada was interested in seeing the Geneva Accords enforced. That would have meant the peaceful reunification of Vietnam by an election in 1956. And America, of course, Dulles made it very clear that he did not agree with the accords and that he did not feel bound by them. The United States did not sign the agreements, and it spent the next years successfully wrecking them. And so that got me interested in Indochina. Even though I was teaching English here, for 2 years I circulated petitions. And then in 1965, there was a visiting Jesuit who was very pro-war, and they somehow picked me out to debate against him. I was supposed to be the naive liberal who didn't know anything about the East, which was almost true at that time. But that got me started in a career of opposing the war in Vietnam.
And so this luck of the draw that brought you to Berkeley, you were essentially positioned to think about what was going on in the world.
Yes, it was a good place to be doing it. I had no intentions of ever doing anything with politics again. And this thing was sort of thrust at me. It wasn't even my choice to go out and speak. First of all, the right wing asked it, and then John Searle drafted me to teach in the first teach-in. And I said, don't get me, I'm a Canadian, get an American. He said, there's no one else. So I gave I was the main speaker at the first teach-in here in Berkeley. Berkeley and Michigan were the two first. We invented the word teach-in in the spring of 1965.
How did this body of experience that you brought to the table affect your perspective as you looked at politics over the following years?
Well, I was different from most people because there were, on the one hand, a number of people who worked with the government and were anxious to defend the government, including my very good friend Aaron Wildavsky. And there were a number of people who had never had anything to do with government who saw government, you know, it was a time of very intense revolutionary rhetoric about overthrowing the government, all nonsense, really. And my position was that I felt that America did some good things in the world. I thought they were quite beneficent in Poland, much more so later on with Solidarity. But so I was not anti-American the way a lot of the student radicals were. And I was very uncomfortable with many of the faculty defending the government, but also very uncomfortable with the rhetoric of the students attacking. I was against the war. For America's sake, I was against the war as well as for Vietnam's sake. So there weren't too many people like me. I was in the middle in some ways.
You are a poet, and you have taught in English poetry, and poetry is the use of words. I'm curious how that sensibility, your sensibility as an artist, informs your political writing, your writing about politics that have been such an important part of your life. Do the two go together well?
I think this book is the first time that one becomes aware that I am a poet and not just. In fact, one of the nice blurbs talks about me writing as a poet, because in the last chapter, this is not, you know, I say some rather harsh things about American policy, but I make it very clear at the beginning that I'm still a Canadian citizen, but America is a country that I truly love. I'm here by choice. I love the American people. I could never say I love the American government, particularly not the present administration. But I see a case of a country that when I came here in 61 was still informed by the kind of visionary ideals that a poet would appreciate. Mm. And as I say in the preface to the book, there were some very acute social problems in the 1960s in this country. But the difference was there was the belief that something could be done about them. A number of people inspired to go out and work for them. I think the history of the civil rights movement in the 1960s is one of the few radiant successes in a dismal century of violence and bloodshed. And in my last chapter, I'm trying to reawake an interest in those ideals. And I do so by pointing not only to the civil rights movement, but also the success of Solidarity in Poland,
which was largely inspired by the great poet Czesław Miłosz. So poetry can help a country sometimes.
Let's talk about the book, and I will show it again to our audience, The Road to 9/11. How long did it take you to write the book?
6 years.
6 years. And let's, I think a very overarching theme here is the difference between the deep state, what you call the deep state, and the mm-hmm. public state. Help us understand the difference between the two.
The term deep state comes from Turkey, and they had to coin it after there was the wreck of a car in which the people who were in the car were a member of parliament, a beauty queen, a local police, quite senior police captain, and the leading drug trafficker in Turkey, who was also the head of a criminal paramilitary organization, the Grey Wolves, that went around killing people. Mm-hmm. And it became very obvious in Turkey that there was some covert relationship
between all of these people.
But particularly between the police, who officially were looking for this man, mm-hmm. even though he was there in the car, mm-hmm. and these people who committed crimes on behalf of the state. Well, the state that you commit crimes for is not a state that can show its hand to the people. It's a hidden state, a covert state. And they called it the deep state, and I've always been talking about deep politics, so it fits very well with mm-hmm. my own analysis. The public state is the one we're taught about in school, and it's true as far as it goes, but all over the world, particularly since World War II, but even before, public states have little escape hatches for when they want to do something illegal. And in this country, the most visible but not the only sign of it is the CIA, which was actually charged quite early on in 1948 to start committing crimes against governments in other parts of the world. So we do have a deep state in America, and the thesis of my book is it's secret, it's not properly controlled. It gets involved in larger and larger enterprises, which were never envisaged, by the way, when the CIA was first created, mm-hmm. Which become more and more disastrous for everybody, including the United States. And the balance between the public state and the deep state has been shifting more and more towards the deep state because there are checks and balances on the public state, and nothing that works by way of checks and balances with the CIA and DIA and the Drug Enforcement Administration, the various components of the deep state.
With your background, what factors do you see accounting for essentially the continuing enlargement of the deep state, the secret activities, and the essential... essentially the inability of the public state, in the case of the United States, the Congress, the system mm-hmm. of checks and balances, to stop this expansion?
Well, here I follow a number of other authors like Chalmers Johnson and particularly Kevin Phillips or Kennedy, you know, the rise and fall of the empires. There's a dynamic. If you have a successful democracy, it will prosper, particularly in contrast to its neighbors. And as it prospers, it expands out beyond its borders. And it becomes involved in other parts of the world. And without any conscious decision, it begins to look more and more like an empire. The institutions that deal with the rest of the world, it's, you know, America is not officially an empire, but there's no shortage of books now that are, including books which support what's happening, admit that it's an empire. The institutions, the public state is set up to govern a democracy, and the checks and balances apply at home. They don't apply overseas. So the gap is filled by the deep state. The CIA is the main presence of the United States in those parts of the world where we do not have formal alliances, which is most of the world, and particularly because we're very dependent on raw materials from the rest of the world, and particularly oil from the rest of the world. The CIA is our main presence in those areas where there is oil, and very foolish enterprises. I cannot think of a single real success story. And here I'm mostly joined by authors like Tim Weiner, who's just done this book, Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. It gives you, or John Prados's book, Safer Democracy, which is his ironic term. They see maybe one or two successes, and they often point to Afghanistan in the 1980s as the success. I see that as one of the biggest disasters of all, because that gave us Al-Qaeda and the terrorist threat that we now face. So it's going to be very difficult to do, but I think we have to somehow get this country to recognize that the deep state is not serving the interests of America. It may be serving the interests of American oil companies, but it is certainly a danger to the American public state, and that's been particularly true in the last 5 years, particularly true since I began my book.
Mm-hmm. Let's, before we look at particular examples of the way this unfolds, and Afghanistan is obviously a likely candidate in our support of the jihadists there. I want to explore something you just raised, which is an important theme in your other works and in this work, namely the link between oil, secret government acting abroad, and drugs. There is an important nexus here, namely, if you're doing all of this off the books and you can't get approval for budgets,
exactly,
then you need to develop an income stream. And talk a little about that.
Well, I think it's no coincidence that if you look at the areas where America counts on to get its oil, which is not primarily the Middle East, actually. Most of that goes to Europe. But there was great talk of oil from Central Asia, particularly as a way of weakening the power of OPEC to set prices.
And this would have been in the 80s, and then especially in the 90s.
Yes.
And during this period, the Soviet Union falls.
Right. But also, if you look at Colombia since 1984, has been the Caño Limón oil field has been an important source. Southeast Asia, wherever the oil is, these are areas where America cannot send its own armies. So it creates alliances with local powers, and time after time, almost without exception, in one way or another, America has created its CIA alliances with what I call drug proxies, because they have their own armies, they do their own enforcement. They're very right-wing.
That is the drug
people.
Yes.
They have to protect themselves against being hijacked by other drug people, so they have their own forces. And we find them there and create alliances with them, but in some significant cases, the CIA virtually created them. This was true in Burma, for example. First major export of opium out of Burma came with the so-called Kuomintang armies there in the 1950s. They were installed and supplied and financed. All the infrastructure was CIA. And and we had, as a result, an opium and heroin epidemic that didn't really end until the end of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And then starting again in 1980... because we went into Afghanistan and sent most of our arms to a man who was already a drug trafficker by the name of Gulbedin Hekmatyar, 79, there were almost no drugs from that part of the world in the United States. By 1981, according to the U.S. government, 60% of the heroin coming into America was coming from the Afghan-Pakistani border. Mm-hmm. As a result of our operations there, the trucks would go up with arms and the trucks would come back down with opium and heroin. Mm-hmm. And we had a second. We had a second involvement in Asia, and we had a second heroin epidemic, which is still with us.
Mm-hmm. So
and by the way, you can just say that now it's something like 95% of the world's heroin comes from Afghanistan, which didn't used to export any back before 1980. So that's what I mean by a disaster.
And as I listen to you, it's as if at one level you're saying the left hand, namely the public state, doesn't know what the right hand, the secret state, is doing. But on the other hand, it does. But I mean, we're talking about this increase in the drug trade at a time when, at home, the public state was saying we had a war on drugs, and we were saying just say no.
Right. Well, the war on drugs, of course, is a bonanza for the drug traffickers because it keeps the prices up. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy. I think that the so-called McGovern reforms in the 1970s, which established congressional control over the CIA in theory, I certainly would have supported them at the time, but actually I think they've made the problem worse, because the real problem is secrecy. Where you have secrecy, you have no rational assessment from outside. And it has to be said that the program in Afghanistan was never publicly debated in Congress, but the Oversight Committee knew all about it and was encouraging it and appropriating money which the CIA didn't even want. So they became part of the problem, because secrecy is the source of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Another theme in your book, and this will, if we talk about this, then we can get into specific examples, is the extraordinary continuity of U.S. foreign policy across administrations, Democrat or Republican,
going in this area,
area of covert operations and so on. So that at the end of World War II, the CIA is established with modest goals, which then grow over time, and that in fact even Democratic administrations become a party to this almost inexorable force. The problem you're saying is because it's not discussed publicly, this is done, you know, all behind closed doors. And let's focus on President Carter, his national security advisor, Brzezinski. The time is the late 70s. The Soviet Union still exists. Brzezinski is from Poland and very concerned about Poland and Eastern Europe, and he focuses on essentially the 100 cuts that he can impose on the Soviet body. And how does that play out in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that Carter, you know, was a member of the Trilateral Commission, of which Brzezinski was the executive director. And the whole idea of the Trilateral Commission was a rather attractive picture of a multipolar world in which America would mediate between the second world, which was the Soviet bloc, and the third world, which were the what we used to call in those days the underdeveloped or lesser developed countries, though I hate that term, having lived in Thailand. In some ways, they're very much more developed than we are, and that's part of the problem. But when they were elected, Carter had a genuine trilateralist, Cyrus Vance, as Secretary of State, and he had as his national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was determined to use the deep state to inflict as much damage on the Soviet Union as he could. And a lot of things which are thought of as the successes of the Reagan regime clearly had their origins under Brzezinski. And it was a total repudiation of what trilateralism stood for. Carter, the poor man, he elected promising cuts in the defense budget. And before he had left, he had committed the Defense Department to huge increases, which actually, again, we associate with the Reagan administration, but were initiated before. What I see happening, there's something we haven't talked about yet, Harry, very important in my book. Is why is the deep state so important in America? Why can't we just say, okay, you've screwed up, you've made things very bad, we'll cut you back? The problem is, and this goes back to the dynamic of democracies becoming empires, we have created a great deal of new wealth in this country, and we have an increasing split between the richest and the poorest. I've never considered myself a Marxist, and I used to say very emphatically that Marx's class analysis just didn't work in America. It works better in the last decade than it ever did before because of the amount of wealth which depends
on things overseas. It isn't just raw materials like oil. It's also outsourcing, having your shoes made in Vietnam instead of in America. All of these things, they wreck the public economy of the public state. So they are weakening the whole, the civil society that sustains the public state. And in the case of Carter now, in the 70s, was a time of a really quite radical shift in the nature of wealth in this country, largely because of the Vietnam War. Eisenhower left warning us about a military-industrial complex and saying it could be a threat. In his own way, he saw what I'm talking about, that there was a force inside society that was threatening to the public order. The Vietnam War vastly increased that military-industrial complex, and then it also created a situation where what we call the traders in the economy, who count on working with the rest of the world, symbolized mostly by the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, they became very worried about the war. And poor Nixon. Nixon had a terrible time to be president because there were powerful forces to continue the war, and the deep state was behind them. And there were powerful forces saying, end it. And Nixon sort of got caught in the jam there. Carter really wanted to go back. I'm sure he sincerely, in his heart, was a trilateralist who wanted to cut back on the military machine. But the enormous wealth of the overworld set up a sustained drumbeat of subsidized by a huge amount of money in the 70s, saying, no, the Soviet Union is a threat, and the CIA has underestimated how dangerous they are. We need to change the estimates. We need to go back to a new... And this was nothing... Carter's personal feelings about this, Cyrus Vance's feelings, had very little to do with it. But Brzezinski was in tune with this new force going on. So Brzezinski became the important man, much more important than the president in the Carter administration.
So that what a president is elected and being open to a new way of looking at the world, but in fact the domestic forces at work really tilted the balance in his own administration, so that a man like Brzezinski, who was focused very much on the Soviet Union and the threat it posed, could essentially say, let's support jihadists in Afghanistan and create a trap and bring the Soviets in. And the Soviets then did invade Afghanistan.
Right, let them have their Vietnam War. That was Brzezinski's own phrase to Carter. He warned Carter. He said, we're going to... Because the first steps in Afghanistan were taken by America, by the deep state, without many people being aware of it. It's usually the ones that most books talk about is the Brzezinski sending, stirring things up against the government in June or July of 1979, knowing that the Soviets may have to respond by invading and wanting that. Mm-hmm. Because he wants to see the Soviet Union bogged down in, as he said, their Vietnam War. It actually started in 78. It gets rather technical, but here's an example of a policy which seems small at the beginning and therefore not much consultation. There are already people in the State Department who say, don't do this. Mm-hmm. But the State Department doesn't count. They're the public state. This is going on in the deep state. And because Brzezinski is in tune with that part of the overworld, the military-industrial complex now is essentially the economy of this country. We have other things. We have aircraft is in between. We certainly have electronics, but even that has primarily got a military component. This is in a militarized economy that we now have. And that's why the overworld has so strengthened the deep state, and the poor members of Congress, they can't even talk about it because they have to get funds from the military-industrial complex to be reelected.
I want to quote you here because you make a reference to Adam Smith, and then and his invisible hand in the economy. And then you write, it's almost as if there's a comparable invisible hand operating in political affairs as well, an impersonal calculus that dictates where a presidency, when guided only by the pursuit of power, will end up despite the president's stated intention. So in the case of Carter, the dynamic pushes him in this direction. And in fact, he also is the one who creates the rapid deployment force for intervention in the Middle East, which then becomes the central...
Right. Brzezinski's idea, even though he wasn't Secretary of Defense. He was
But then we elect a conservative president, President Reagan. Mm-hmm. He appoints as head of the CIA what we might call a cowboy, named Bill Casey, who had a long experience in the OAS and was
OSS
and was a New York banker, and they really ratchet up the ante, because what Carter and Brzezinski have done is laid the groundwork for Americans' secret involvement in Afghanistan against the Soviets by supporting the Islamic fundamentalists. Along comes Casey and ups the ante.
And really cashes in, you might say. That quote you gave from it was actually about the Ford administration, and it applies. The more you go back, the more you see the seeds further and further back.
Which is why this understanding the historical continuity is very important.
Ford, of course, came in after Nixon resigned, never elected, and his stated purpose was to heal the nation, which badly needed healing at that time. And yet, before he left, Ford appointed a chief of staff by the name of Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld hired a deputy by the name of Cheney. And what happened in the course of the 2 years of the Ford administration was that Ford shifted the country away from Kissinger's policies of détente with the Soviet Union towards Reagan's policy of heightening the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Cheney and Rumsfeld, who became very much more important later on, we'll come back to them. I say this of them, that I'm not even sure that they came into office with this goal in mind, but the dynamics of what was happening, and particularly this huge public relations campaign going on outside the administration.
This is the Ford administration. Actually.
The Ford administration, the crucial year, 75. I call that the critical, originally I wrote the whole book I thought I'd just skip Ford, and then I realized that I could drop any other chapter, but I could not avoid Ford. Because that's the shift from Kissinger's goal of living with the Soviet Union to what became eventually the explicit Reaganite goal of destroying the Soviet Union. And that it really happened under Ford. And then, as you said, Casey came in. And the largest, most expensive by far, covert operation. Covert. It was a war, but it was technically.
It was covert in the American sense. We didn't know what we were supporting.
The whole world was getting good news about it, except the United States. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. press were remarkably silent. And Casey didn't even trust. He's put in over the CIA partly because these right wingers, which now had taken over the government, they didn't like the CIA because they had been giving these unfortunately accurate estimates of Soviet strength, which was not all that much. The Soviet regime was already in acute problems, which only became worse through the 80s. And he conducted a lot of his operations, not even through, I don't want to make a general pattern, but often he would go outside. He had the power of being director of Central Intelligence. He would go off and meet with people in Saudi Arabia, or he'd meet with the head of something called the Bank of Credit and Commerce International and commit to all kinds of engagements with the drug traffickers in Afghanistan, which don't show up in CIA records, and which cast an enormous shadow over the history of the world, because there are the true seeds of al-Qaeda and the terrorist, it's not even just al-Qaeda, but the terrorist threat
which we face in Asia and to some extent now in Europe and even Latin America.
You enumerate, and we don't have to go into this in detail because there's so much to discuss here, but I'll just put it on the table, and people should go out and read your book and buy it. The KC legacy includes favoring the Islamic fundamentalists over the native Sufi nationalists, so siding with one side
in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, sponsoring the Afghan Arabs, namely
Arab Afghans.
The Arab Afghans in the sense of moving people from the Arab world who were jihadists to fight in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union.
Yes, not just in Afghanistan, but also over the river, the Aral River, and into the Amu Darya, into what was then the Soviet Union. They were actually conducting raids in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. So the whole idea of financing this international force was eagerly supported by Casey. And Brzezinski's responsible, too, you know, and there was a famous interview he had with Le Nouvel Observateur in France in the 1990s, and they said, when you look back on that, aren't you a little upset at what you did in creating this terrorist movement? And Brzezinski said then, and he may wish he hadn't, but he said, what's more important, the fall of the Soviet mm-hmm. Union or a few agitated Muslims? Mm-hmm. Well, the few agitated Muslims have become absolutely central now to American foreign policy.
Third element in this Casey equation was exploiting narcotics as a way to weaken the Soviet Union. That is, getting narcotics to Soviet soldiers, I guess.
Yes, right.
So to demoralize the army. And then the fourth that you mentioned, you talk about in the book, which you just touched upon, expanding the Afghan resistance to a global arm to attack the Soviet Union itself. So in other words, seeing the movement of these jihadists out of Afghanistan into the various stan states that were part of the Soviet
right,
Union,
yes.
And then later into Bosnia.
And that's quite true. And Kosovo.
Yeah.
Except they were our allies in Kosovo.
Yeah. And then finally, supplying.
They were sort of our allies in Bosnia, too. It was a very complex situation.
Continuing to supply the Islamicists after the Soviet withdrawal.
Yes. I'd like to say a bit. One thing I didn't stress in my book, but really belongs in that list, and it was definitely Casey. Was to, you know, after 1985, we had Gorbachev. And eventually, Margaret Thatcher and eventually Ronald Reagan decided that they liked Gorbachev and wanted to deal with him. Casey never stopped trying to destroy Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. And something which I don't talk much about in my book, but is definitely the case, manipulating the price of oil, driving it way, way down, so that oil was the main source of foreign exchange earnings for the Soviet Union. Mm. And none of Gorbachev's reforms would work because the predicted income from the sale of oil to Europe, Western Europe, never materialized. And so he successfully destroyed Gorbachev. Was that for the good of the world? I mean, I'm not anti-Putin particularly or anti-Yeltsin, but there was a moment of opportunity with Gorbachev, which Casey was destroying even when Reagan wanted it. Now, that is, to me, a symptom that the deep state has become very dangerous to the policy goals of the public state of this country. And on the narcotics thing, this is where... there's some very good books about the CIA being written recently, one by Tim Weiner, one by John Prados. But because they talk to the CIA officers and they've been shown, I think, quite a few, particularly Weiner, has looked at the recently declassified CIA documents, they don't talk about the drugs because the drugs are so deep, they're not even in the CIA documents. But they're certainly there. And if you read the best history of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International,
which was a bank, which was a vehicle for moving a lot of this drug money.
Yes, it was a global drug laundering bank, and it was huge, and it was corrupting, by the way, with its budget, with its resources, corrupting leading politicians, presidents, prime ministers all over the world. And a lot of that money, there's not much talked about, but it's true, was reaching politicians in the United States, politicians of both parties, which is one reason why we don't get a congressional investigation of BCCI. There was actually a report this thick that came out, one Republican, Hank Brown, one Democrat, John Kerry, and Hank Brown congratulated Kerry on having the courage to do this when so many people in his party were, affected by the bank. The bank was a big factor in the creating the connections with people like Hekmatyar. Hekmatyar in the 80s was probably the leading heroin trafficker in the world, and he was the leading recipient of CIA largesse, supplemented by an equal amount of Saudi Arabian money. There's something terribly wrong in a situation like this.
To sum up here, what you're basically saying is that the secret government, let's call it that, because...
But many people do.
Yeah,
I try to avoid the phrase because it's like fascism, yeah. It's a bit tarnished. But the
secret government funds operations, and the consequences of its mistaken choices, which are not debated publicly in the United States, leads to outcomes away. So that, for example, in supporting Hekmatyar, you're supporting a guy who's into drugs mm-hmm. and who doesn't have a base of support, in Afghanistan. So you're really distorting democracy, the hopes that we might have for democracy elsewhere.
You raised that point before, and I should have responded to it. It's always presented in America that we were helping the Afghan freedom fighters. We weren't. Mm-hmm. There were Afghan freedom fighters, and as you already said, they were largely Sufi. It was a traditional Islam that would be easy to live with. But because we were working with proxy governments, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, we worked with their favorite candidates who were, and especially in the case of Pakistan was a bit worried about the indigenous Afghan resistance because they laid claim to the northwestern provinces of Pakistan, which are mostly Pashtun. And they, in Afghanistan, they feel they should be part. It was a British boundary, the Durand Line. And the real freedom fighters didn't recognize that line. Hekmatyar recognized the line because he was a creation of the Pakistani Secret Service, the ISI. Mm-hmm. And so Pakistan insisted that the money go to these two. There were the two leaders, Hekmatyar, who was Pakistan's creation, and Abdul Razaf, Abdul Sayyaf, who was the creation of the Saudis. Neither of them had much support inside Afghanistan, but much worse, both of them were Islamic fundamentalists, Islamists, extremists, as opposed to this indigenous Sufi Islam that I wish we could get back. Well, it's still there, of course, but and they feel victimized by these people. In came these Arab Afghans, and they smashed cemeteries, said you shouldn't have tombstones. The Afghans were not being liberated by these people. They were being tyrannized by these people.
I'm going to show your book again and recommend it at this point because we can't go into all this detail this interview, but I think it's suggestive as to why the audience should go out and buy the book. But I want to bring up another element, which I think is very important, and that is the book's called The Road to 9/11, which we've really just discussed. But I want to talk about your ideas in the book about the importance of what is called COG, C-O-G, the continuity of government plans.
Right.
Because part of the way the government has adapted to its concerns about the world is to create a set of plans as to how the government would respond in the case of nuclear attack.
Initially, it was nuclear attack.
This would be in the 80s, and the people involved in this centrally were Rumsfeld and Cheney even when they were in the
private... And Oliver North and George H.W. Bush.
Right. Mm-hmm. But even when any of these individuals were not in government, they were part of these plans, which were exercises to how to confront the possibility of a nuclear attack. And what you're arguing in the latter part of your book is that these plans were implemented...
Partially,
as the 9/11 attacks began. Talk
yes.
a little about that, because what you're suggesting is that they led to a situation where on that day there were exercises being undertaken to deal with a possible attack, not knowing that attack was going to happen that day, which may have led to confusion. There were changes in the rules of engagement.
Yes.
And then there's the mysterious disappearance of Cheney and Rumsfeld during a brief period when the attack was underway. It's a lot to cover, but yeah. the idea here basically is that there are plans and they got activated.
Let's deal with the broad outlines
yeah.
first. The COG, this is another thing which we associate with Reagan, but actually began under Carter, although Carter may never have been aware of it. Carter did create FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which has always been charged with being the infrastructure for this planning. What is kind of shocking, really, I mean, these are extreme plans. Congress didn't know about them in the 80s. About a small group of people were assigned to work on them by an executive order from Reagan. It came up in the Iran-Contra hearings. A congressman asked Oliver North, is it true that you've been working on plans to suspend the American Constitution? And Senator Inouye wrapped his gavel and said, we can't go into that here. This was what Congressman Brooks was asking about was COG, and it was happening. And as you just said, Cheney was a congressman at the time from representing Wyoming. But Rumsfeld was not in the government at all. He was the head, he was the CEO of a drug company. And yet they were planning for the suspension of parts of the American Constitution, and Congress didn't know. Now, talk about the deep state sailing completely free. Here the deep state is planning to suspend the public state. I always say COG really stands for change of government. If you're suspending the Constitution, that's not continuity. That is a very significant change. In the two best books on this by James Mann and James Bamford are not aware that the planning continued under Clinton in the 1990s. And according to Andrew Coburn in his new book on Rumsfeld, Clinton didn't know about them. But now neither Cheney nor Rumsfeld are in the government, but they're still planning for the suspension of the Constitution. And somebody who worked with them and was a source for Coburn said, you know, before it had always been a mix of Democrats and Republicans. Now they were all Republicans and they all hated Clinton and they acted like a government in waiting. Well, one of the first things that happened when Bush was, I don't want to say elected, but when George W. became the president, he put Cheney in charge of a group to plan for a terrorist attack. This is May of 2001, 5 months before 9/11. And he's to work with FEMA. Well, he's been working with FEMA for 20 years, so it wasn't like there was any real change here. And everyone recognizes that one of the crucial reasons why those planes were able to get to the buildings on 9/11...
The hijackers,
without interception, is because on June 1st of 2001, the rules for intercepting a plane were changed, and before it was just an automatic thing. A plane goes off course, fighter planes go up, and they intercept it doesn't mean they shoot it down. They just get there to see what's going to happen. Some people may remember when the golfer Payne Stewart, his plane went off course. The fighter planes were up there. The system which was able to intercept Payne Stewart's plane was not able to intercept any
of the planes on 9/11. And the reason, this is according to the 9/11 Commission report, is one of the very few things where I agree with them, is because of a new rule instituted on June the 1st, which said now you had to get approval from National Command Authority. Well, what a crazy rule. I mean, absolutely insane rule. I understand that the rule was repealed in December of 2001, but this is clearly a reason why it was difficult to intercept the planes. Impossible. Didn't happen.
So, in other words, the centralization of power.
Yes.
Essentially,
put it in the deep state.
Put it in the deep state and prevents the kind of flexible response that may, at a lower level, maybe not have stopped the planes, but would have alerted the government.
No, it would have been different.
We assume it would have been different. Yeah.
And now I've given you some facts up to now, and one more fact is it is an absolutely clear fact. COG was instituted on September the 11th. It was. And a number of people left Washington. You know, we have these hollowed out mountains which had become the emergency headquarters. And those buildings were occupied for several weeks after 9/11 by about 100 bureaucrats. We don't really know what they're doing, but I speculate that what they were doing all these things. They produced the Patriot Act out of nowhere, like a magician bringing a rabbit out of a hat, or Lyndon Johnson producing the Tonkin Gulf Resolution out of a hat. They produced the Patriot Act, which I think is an outgrowth of COG planning. The things that we know were planned for in the 1980s under COG, warrantless wiretapping, warrantless detention, possibly even massive detention. That hasn't happened yet, but planning for massive detention has already happened. And all of these, and in the Homeland Security homepage, when they're talking about it, they say the planning was done in 2001. Well, I think it was probably done in those hollowed out mountains. There is a very tight correlation between what Oliver North was accused of doing in the 1980s and what has actually happened in this country since 9/11. So, you know, there is Congressman Kucinich wants to impeach Vice President Cheney. I think it's premature to impeach him. First of all, I know it wouldn't succeed. And secondly, I don't think the evidence is there myself. But I do think the evidence is there for a congressional committee to call in Vice President Cheney and say, what were you doing in that group in May? Did you have anything to do with this? The 9/11 Commission wasn't curious as to where this June 1st crazy ordinance came from. He should be asked to testify about that under oath, because Americans should understand that all kinds of people testified about 9/11 under oath to the 9/11 Commission, but Bush and Cheney came together so they wouldn't contradict each other and were allowed to testify not under oath. Well, I would say it's a matter of the very highest priority that Cheney testify for the first time under oath.
I will just give our audience a teaser so they'll go out and buy the book, but there's a very interesting period of time after the attacks by the hijackers have begun, in which the public record doesn't account for Cheney and Rumsfeld's time, suggesting, you are suggesting in the book, that what the cog was activated and decisions may have been made that should also be a matter of public discussion. But we don't have time to go into that. But I suggest that the audience read that and see if they agree with you. But what I want to ask you, because our time is running out, what I want to ask you is, because somebody out there might be watching and saying, well, what's his evidence for this? And obviously there is a public record, books like Steve Cole's book on American involvement in Afghanistan, and many others which you have named.
Yes.
But you are creating a mosaic here, which is a much broader systemic look at what was happening.
Right.
And so your critics might say, well, do you really have evidence for all that that you're charging, or is it speculative? So what I want to ask you is, what is your theory of how you piece things together, even though you may be wrong about some things and but right about many more?
Well, I've been called a connective journalist. I don't do much interviewing of people in high places, mostly because they usually won't speak to me. Most of the book, I would say 95% of the book, is from publicly available sources. And when possible, I cite sources on the internet. Now, of course, there's all kinds of crazy junk on the internet. I'm the first to concede that. I try to work as best I can with sources that are impeccable. And not if a source is going to be challenged, I would, even if it's perfect for my purposes, I'd rather not touch it. So when we come to BCCI, for example, and well, it's not there in the CIA records, but this book about BCCI is written by two Wall Street journalists. I think they won an award for it. So I'm going to an impeccable, unimpeachable source. Now, in some areas, admittedly, I go beyond those sources, but I try to be very explicit when I am. And there was one time when I cite a source about 9/11, and I say, you know, I suspect this is true, but this should be formulated as a question, not as a fact. Mm-hmm. And this is the sort of thing that Cheney should be asked. So in the 5% where I go beyond, it's usually, I would say, the most reasonable extrapolation from the available evidence, and it's the agenda for further inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And at one point you suggest that you actually look at the public record and the evidence and ask yourself, well, what's not there, and
yes,
why is it not there?
Right. And you were referring to that a moment. In the case, there's 10 crucial minutes, or maybe 15 or 20 crucial minutes, on the morning of 9/11, shortly before 10 o'clock, when the most important decisions were made, including COG, and the Karl Rove's account of what the president did is visibly false. The 9/11 Commission have a different account. This is when Rumsfeld says he went out and helped put people on stretchers in the yard of the Pentagon. What? The head of our armed forces is out there putting people on stretchers when the nation is under attack? I don't think he was putting people on stretchers. And then there's a similar mystery about Cheney, because decisions were made of which there is no record, even in the records of the bunker. They kept records in the bunker, and there's suddenly a period when there crucial decisions were made, crucial phone calls were made. They have a record of phone calls. This phone call is not on the record, and I think that 10 minutes of mystery is the key to the 9/11 mystery.
Peter, I'm sorry to say we've run out of time. I think that we want to show your book again. It's available from UC Press, and I think people...
It's in bookstores.
You know,
it's
in bookstores.
Amazon.
Okay, so they can go out and get it, and they're going to want to do that to pursue some of these mysteries that you've uncovered for us. So, but I want to thank you for taking the time to be on our program and sharing with us the background and the history that involved in revealing this mosaic of where we are and really with the hopes that the future will be different.
I'm just sorry there wasn't time to talk about my last chapter, because I am hopeful for America. My hopes are with the American people.
Good. And they will read that last chapter, because there is a plan of action there. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.